This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss mood, energy, and brain fog in perimenopause with naturopath Dr. Dasha Leneva. We'll find out if we can really live forever with health researcher David Nelson. We'll learn about post-surgery and trauma diets with registered dietitian Shauna Lindzen. And lastly, we'll discover who's responsible for triggering in a public setting with psychologist Aaron McGann. Before we get to that, here's your Tonic Quick Shot. Researchers at UT Southwestern Medical Center have discovered how a hormone called SCG2 helps cancer cells escape the body's immune system. Their study, published in Nature Immunology, shows that SCG2 binds to a receptor called LILRB4 on immune cells known as myeloid cells. Normally, these cells help fight tumors, but when LILRB4 is activated by SCG2, they lose their ability to attack cancer and even stop recruiting cancer-fighting T cells. Dr. Chengcheng Zhang and his team found that in mice engineered with a human form of LILRB4, cancer cells producing SCG2 grew quickly. When researchers blocked LILRB4 or removed SCG2, cancer growth slowed significantly. This suggests that the SCG2-LILRB4 interaction plays a key role in helping tumors grow unchecked. The findings could lead to new cancer immunotherapies, especially since current treatments only work for about 20 to 30% of patients. Blocking SCG2 or LILRB4 may give doctors another tool to boost the immune system's fight against cancer. On the other hand, increasing SCG2 might someday help to treat autoimmune or inflammatory diseases by calming overactive immune responses. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: the Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Dasha Leneva in a moment. But first, a little bit of business. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores. Today, we're tackling what feels like a hormonal roller coaster for many women in their 40s and 50s, and that is perimenopause. It's not just about hormones dropping, it's about unpredictable swings. With me is Dr. Dasha Leneva, frequent guest, who will unpack what's really happening and how to support mood, energy, and brain health during this transition. Welcome to the show, Dasha. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me again.
So let's start with the basics. What exactly is happening to women's hormones during perimenopause?
Well, lots of things. So let's take a step back and appreciate that females are born with all the eggs they'll ever have. And as we age, this ovarian reserve, which is established prior to birth, declines continuously. And during menopause, this reserve is when it gets really low. And this depletion of follicles actually leads to this wonderful roller coaster that we call perimenopause. And we don't get this gradual decline in hormones like a male would with a lower testosterone, but we actually get this abrupt rise and fall of hormones, so estrogen and progesterone, and this leads to things like irregular cycles, hot flashes, mood changes, insomnia, among other symptoms.
And how do those ups and downs affect mood and brain function?
Yeah, so estrogen fluctuations disrupt the brain's energy supply and communication between neurons, and this can lead to cognitive difficulties and increased mood changes. And progesterone also plays a role in this. So drops in progesterone can lead to brain fog, anxiety, insomnia. And we all know what a lack of sleep can do to our brains as well. So it's like this perfect storm of all these things happening at once.
Right. So you alluded to it off the top about how men sometimes experience, you know, the drop off in testosterone. And we sometimes hear about low estrogen, but you're actually saying that variability is the culprit.
Yeah, for the most part, you definitely can have symptoms when estrogen is low overall, but it's more so that variability that leads to the more symptomatic picture. If you think about it this way, like imagine you're driving a car, it's a little older and the fuel gauge is broken, and you'll get in the car and some days the tank looks full, so like high estrogen state, for example, and other days it looks empty even though you just filled it. So that's the low estrogen example. And the car sort of lurches forward, stalls, surges unpredictably, and the ride is really unpleasant and bumpy and you can't predict it. And then eventually, as we kind of enter this steady cruise, this gauge levels out, which is like the post-menopause spot. So we get lots of unpredictability, ups and downs, lots of analogies we can use to explain exactly what's happening.
But it isn't just hormone levels. There's a new study out earlier this year suggesting that iron levels may play a role in brain function during menopause. Can you explain that connection?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I will preface this by saying it's not just in perimenopause and menopause that low iron can affect cognition. It's at any stage of life. I think this is just the first time that they've really, or you know, there's not a lot of studies being done on perimenopausal women with low iron. But yes, in the study, they looked at how iron levels impacted cognition in peri and postmenopausal women. They used blood tests, MRI based brain measurements, and then cognitive testing. And they found that women with higher iron status had better cognitive performance. So like I said, we know that iron deficiency in general is linked with fatigue, brain fog, poor concentration, cold hands and feet, afternoon crashes, and this can even be without anemia, which is actually exactly what they looked for in this study. It was specifically iron deficiency without anemia. So it's basically showing us how important this nutrient is.
Okay. So let's round out the rest of the picture that women should look at. Like, what natural supports are out there to help women through this transition, in addition to perhaps hormone therapy or iron? Let's sort of cover all the bases.
Yeah, totally. So to be very transparent, for perimenopause and menopause, I only really use hormone replacement therapy. So like topical estrogen and oral progesterone. They have great research behind them and control symptoms to a greater extent. However, there are people that are not great candidates for HRT, or some people just don't want to take it or don't tolerate it well. So in those situations, that's when we can utilize the more natural products. So for hot flashes, night sweats, we can use soy isoflavones, red clover, black cohosh, chase tree, evening primrose oil. For mood, stress, and brain fog, chase tree is great, St. John's wort, magnesium, ashwagandha, B vitamins, and obviously iron, which we already talked about. And then there's like insomnia that we can tackle. So magnesium and valerian are great for that. And of course, one of the most important aspects, is bone health, right? So using vitamin D, making sure calcium is up, and then magnesium as well.
Okay, so you know on the Tonic, we're all about lifestyle. What are some habits that women really need to consider during perimenopause?
Totally. Yeah, you probably know what I'm going to say, but going back to the basics and making sure that nutrition, sleep, stress, and exercise are all sorted. We know how important it is to maintain muscle, and not only to support bone health, right, but to support energy, metabolism, and mobility later in life. We also know that alcohol and caffeine can actually make these perimenopausal symptoms worse. So limiting those is wise. We don't have to make things too complicated, right? We just have to do our best to create sustainable habits that we can bring to our older years.
What I'm learning, and I'm constantly learning through this show, is, you know, the decisions that we make sort of before we enter into these life transitions are actually, you know, incredibly impactful as we get older. So for our listeners out there who are in their 30s or perhaps early 40s, is there anything that they can do sort of as preventative measures?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, like you said, preventative measures. So the time before perimenopause is the time to make action. So if you're like in your 20s, 30s, and 40s, that's a great place to start. And it's never too late, but building muscle, having enough protein, making sure that iron levels, vitamin D levels are good. Calcium is important as well. I believe that dietary calcium is a little bit better than supplemental calcium, but if there is a deficiency in how much you're getting, obviously you can add a supplement to that. And then stress management and weight management are important to establish early on too, because as we get older, it's a lot harder to lose weight and to put on muscle and do all the things, right? We rather would not be working from a place of deficiency, but from a place of sufficiency.
And of course, there's another piece of the puzzle too, which, you know, it's kind of it's a loaded phrase, but I think in this context, you know, it makes sense. And that's self-care. How does that fit into the picture?
Yeah. I mean, when we look at perimenopausal females, we see that they have increased insomnia, anxiety, mood swings, things like that. And let's say you're not taking care of yourself, you're getting poor sleep, you're not managing stress, all of those symptoms can be exacerbated. So just taking time for yourself, whether it is to read a book, you know, go for a walk, exercise, just showing up for yourself can make a big difference in those symptoms as well.
So a lot of what we've talked about is sort of generalized and, you know, obviously good advice. But, you know, as a practitioner, I'm sure you see this with your patients coming in with all sorts of symptomology, which may or may not be common. So what are you seeing?
Yeah. So again, I'm seeing all the classic symptoms like the hot flashes, night sweats, anxiety, insomnia, things like that. But we're also seeing a lot of things like frozen shoulder, which has now been connected to perimenopause, lots of itchy skin, dry skin. I do have a bit of a focus in dermatology and aesthetics as well. And I have been seeing increased skin laxity with perimenopause too. And we know as estrogen drops, we also have that drop in collagen as well. So there's lots of things we can do to address that. Other things that come up a lot, which are really big and uncomfortable, and sometimes it's a little bit stressful for people to talk about, but vaginal dryness is another one, right? And low libido. So those are kind of most of the things that I see in the office.
So what would you do for somebody with low libido? Like, does the hormone therapy play into that? Or are there other things that can be done?
Yes, it can. So estrogen and progesterone can definitely help. But if it's very severe, testosterone can be prescribed at low levels for women, because we, you know, sometimes we forget that women have testosterone too, and that plays an important role. But I do also find that making sure that sleep is good, managing stress also impacts libido as well. So that's when we can use some of our natural supplements like ashwagandha, rhodiola, maca, reishi, in order to help kind of regulate that nervous system piece and ideally help improve libido. That's where I would usually start and then kind of work up from there.
A few minutes ago, we sort of mentioned women in their 30s and 40s, and I've had other naturopaths come on and talk about establishing screening and blood testing to get baseline levels of hormones. Is that something you're doing in your practice? And are people asking you about that?
I get a lot of questions on that. Clinically, oftentimes it's not really necessary to establish a baseline of hormones unless there is like a significant symptomatic picture. And even in perimenopause, oftentimes we won't test hormones, but we'll do other screening tests like looking at cardiometabolic health, such as cholesterol, blood sugar, liver enzymes, things like that, in order to see what those levels are rather than testing hormones. Because again, as we know, levels are going to drop. So we can kind of be safe to assume if you're having these symptoms, this is the way to treat that.
We recently did a segment on the show regarding men and their sort of feedback when it comes to perimenopause and menopause, because, you know, so many women of the cohort are in relationships. What are you seeing in your practice? Are you treating couples, and what sort of feedback are you getting from men regarding how their partners are being impacted by perimenopause?
Yeah, so I don't typically see couples together, but sometimes I will see them separately. And the biggest feedback I get is, I have no idea why my partner suddenly hates me. And around that, we do a lot of education about what perimenopause is, why their partner could be feeling that way, and trying to get the partner to actually understand, hey, you know, this is like a crazy hormonal roller coaster that the partner is on. And yes, they don't hate you, but at the same time, sometimes it's hard for them to regulate their emotions. And once we get them to a stable base, things will likely get better. But just trying to introduce them a little bit more compassion in that regard, and just educating on, like, know that your partner doesn't hate you. Their fuse is just a little bit shorter than it once was.
Dash, I think you have to be open to the possibility that these partners are actually just jerks, and their wives or partners actually do hate them. I mean, I've been with my wife for a long time. I can tell you, you know, there's good days and bad days, and sometimes it has nothing to do with hormones at all. So, you know, obviously I'm joking. Thank you so much for coming on the show today and explaining that background of what can happen during perimenopause.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Dashiell and Ava. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss whether we can really live forever on The Tonic.
Does your reflection match how you feel, or are stubborn areas holding you back? At Form, Face, and Body, they specialize in restoring your youthful glow and sculpting the body you desire, so your outer appearance reflects your inner vitality. Visit formfacebody.ca and see how they can help you rediscover your confidence. Call 416-447-6176 to schedule your complimentary consultation and reclaim your vitality.
I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
David Nelson is a fellow at In Vivo Planetary Health, a part of the NOVA Institute for Health of People, Places, and Planet, located in Baltimore, Maryland. He attended the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine, is a health, food, retail, and wellness services business owner. He's also written numerous academic articles, and he's a frequent guest on this show. Welcome back, David. How are you?
Doing great, Jamie. Had a good summer. A little hot once in a while, but yeah, it was really good. Feeling good.
So I brought you on the show because you're my agent in the field. You know, something comes up, and I see it as a trend. I wonder if it has merit. And I bring you in to have a look at it because you've got a critical eye, and I appreciate what you do. So today, I want to talk about Brian Johnson, who some people are familiar with and some aren't. He's got a show on Netflix, but before that, there was tons of press. He's very wealthy, but he spends, I think it's something like $1 million or $2 million a year on supplements and procedures, including harvesting the blood of his son. In order to stay younger. So I am wondering if any of this makes sense and if there's any practical takeaways. Can you help us with that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's look at the big top down pieces first. What is he really saying? What are the fundamental stuff before he starts going into the very specific dosages of a supplement? He talks about sleep. He says sleep really matters. And you do need to consistently put in, you know, 6 to 8, 7 to 9 hours. You need to take quality wind down time, which we don't do as much as a society. So he's right on that. Two, you have to you got to move like you mean it. And this is one of the things that he talks about. Like, if you don't move your body in a particular way, like you mean it, you're informing your body, I want to keep this function going. And if you don't do that and you don't do the exercise, your body adapts to the more sedentary aspect of your life. So that's true. And then from a food perspective, he's big on two things, fiber and polyphenols. They're prebiotics. They influence and feed the microbiome. So it's not just about your macros. That's what's important here. You need to have at least some exposure to fiber and polyphenols, plants, diversity, things like, you know, legumes, nuts, extra virgin olive oil, whole grains, which have 60 to 85% of their polyphenols are bound to their fiber. So if you remove the fiber from a grain, you're taking out a lot of those polyphenols. So those are the three big pieces that I would say 100% we can take away from Brian Johnson about living well for a long time. Sleep like it matters. Train like you mean it. And then eat fiber and polyphenols as part of a whole foods kind of exposure. You know, that idea of eating 30 different, you know, plants in a week is a good idea.
Let's talk about the way his message is presented, though. Like, what are your thoughts on that? Like, is it necessary to go to the extremes that he does, number one? Is it necessary to espouse the extremes that he does, number two, to capture people's attention on this?
Yeah. So, that's an incredibly good question, because the longest lived people in the world now actually don't necessarily draw themselves that much attention, nor do they have this many rules or supplements. So there's a very interesting kind of tension between, can the technology deliver, and do the people who have already lived a long life without technology or technological intervention, how did they do it?
Right.
And what's the intersection points between? It's a really important question. So I'm glad that you raised it. You know what I'm going to talk about? Let's talk about what's speculative, what might have a mixed backing of research, and then what is truly solid. So what we talked about before, the solid research where he's coming from, sleep, move, eat.
Yep.
That's solid. Mixed, time-restricted eating or calorie control. Time-restricted feeding windows, doing an 18-6 or something where you stop eating at 6, 7, or 8, that type of stuff. That's mixed. Some studies show positive benefit. Some studies in certain metabolic fragility people where they have, you know, reactive hypoglycemia and diabetes, they don't do as well on that. They have to eat differently. And then speculative, the young plasma, that's an animal model. We've never seen it play out in human trials. And then the supplements, I'm in the supplement business, right? So I formulate and I own retail locations. So I deal with this on a regular basis. I believe in them. But taking 120 different or 105, I'm not sure what he's at right now. I think it's 120 different supplements a day. What you're doing is you're taking very linear. You're trying to combine everything that nature's doing or what the science has found. But people who live really long lives aren't taking 120 things. They might be taking 5 to 10. But I don't know that you need to spend $1 million a year to live to be 120.
I don't even know if I want to live to 120, candidly.
Well, it depends. Okay. Can we talk about that for a second?
Yeah,
thank you for saying that. There's a difference between lifespan and health span.
Exactly.
And he seems to be kind of looking at both at the same time, but we focus on the longevity in terms of numbers. The new frameworks coming out are people want to live well for as long as they can, not live as long as they can despite how well they feel. Right.
Well, also, like, let's look at what it takes. Like, if it takes harvesting the plasma of your offspring in order to live longer, well, first of all, nobody's going to do that. And two, like, to what end? Right. Like,
and who's donating the plasma under what consent?
And who has the resources to do this? And,
yeah, right.
And,
absolutely.
And, you know, it's like a few years back, there was this movement, like extreme calorie restriction. Where people were like eating like maybe 40% of the calories of the North American diet, and they were living longer, but they looked horrible. They looked frail.
Right.
They looked like they were about to keel over. And there's got to be a balance, isn't it? Like what's the purpose?
Well,
what's the purpose of living longer if it's going to suck? Like I don't get it.
100% agree. 100% agree on that. And I think that that's one of the criticisms. Now, I mean, I like the fact that Brian Johnson is bringing attention to the space of investing in longevity and kind of helping yourself to be healthy in your environment, eating well. Like, he's bringing some attention to that. Great. But at the same time, it's like you said, people don't necessarily have the resources, that's time and or money, to be able to do those things. We have to be making statements about longevity and health span that can actually cover the population with the current resources that we have. And some are really low tech. People don't want to talk about them. But it's like putting your phone down and doing some meditation and eating some fiber. That goes a long way, man.
I know it does. You know, I wonder when AI comes and takes everybody's jobs, you know, with all the with all the free time, will people, you know, everybody's terrified that there's going to be nothing to do. Well, you know, not everybody's going to be a great musician or a great artist, but maybe they'll have the time to take care of themselves. But like, here's the thing. Like, I have the luxury of enough time and the resources to make dinner like from scratch.
Right.
Every single day. Okay. Yep. Now, I'm not making 3-course meals every day, but it allows me to harvest the fresh vegetables that I grow in the back of my garden. Yep. And it allows me the time to go shop for the good ingredients. And I have the resources to buy organics or higher quality foods. But I appreciate I am not the average Canadian. I mean, who has the time to do it? Who has the time to spend an hour a day to cook dinner? I just don't think people do. I don't.
Yeah. This is one of the things that we're going to have to confront from a societal standpoint. So either, you know, two things have to happen. Either people, A, have to have more free time, and they also need to be trained in the skill of cooking. It used to happen, but I mean, there are people that truly don't know how to cook, and that's okay. It's not a judgment. It's a lack of environmental education from either peers, parents, or schools, where we didn't make it part of what we thought was really important in terms of education. Kids know their times tables to X number of whatever, but they can't tell you how much fiber they ate. This is a problem.
I think what's going to happen, I have these dystopian views, but like, I think it's going to be a class issue. Like,
you're right.
I think there's going to be.
Well, you're talking about, there's a guy by the name of Paul Zane Pilser. He wrote a book at the turn of the last millennium called The Next Trillion. And what he did, he was an economist that worked for a couple different presidents in the U.S.
Yep.
And what he did is he looked at the arc of two things, healthcare and food. And he saw that they were going to be $1 trillion businesses, and he predicted another $1 trillion business. That was wellness. And here's what he said. Pharmaceutical companies are going to keep people just healthy enough so that packaged food companies can keep people just unhealthy enough, that pharmaceutical companies can keep people just healthy enough. We just saw this with GLP-1s.
Yep.
Where people said, well, eat whatever you want, but take a GLP-1. You lose weight anyways.
You know,
so this is a problem
in
the messaging.
I agree. And the interesting thing is, if you watch carefully, the message from the producers of the GLP-1 agonists as supplements, and by that I mean people who are taking it for weight loss and not to treat a medical condition – they're very clear that you have to eat a balanced diet, that you have to exercise not to lose your muscle mass. They say it, but that's not the message that's being received. I agree with you. Most people is like, oh, man, it's a great shortcut. I don't have the willpower. I'm not able to. I've tried for years. I yo-yo up and down. I've got the weight. But now if I take this pill, it makes life a whole lot easier. And I hear you. And if I'm them, I get why they're doing it. I totally do. And I say that as somebody who was like at one point 50, 60 pounds overweight. I totally get it. It's hard.
Yeah, it is hard.
I don't know. I don't know how we break this cycle. And I truly agree with you. I think it starts with kids. I think, you know, we got to make sure they're getting phys ed. We've got to make sure that people have time for exercise. You know,
and then we do need to look at populations that seem to be getting good outcomes out of the way they're doing it. The Japanese are a good example. All the food for Japanese children is made at the school with the kids' help, and Japan still has it's going up due to certain issues, but they still have incredible good health outcomes, good longevity metrics, and good obesity and metabolic metrics. So there's something to be said about the way that they manage that.
Yeah, I'm not sure in North America, with all our freedoms, that we'd be willing to live culturally like other cultures do. You give up a fair bit of autonomy that I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I think we perhaps overvalue some of that autonomy and undervalue other aspects of that autonomy. A discussion for another day. So
yeah, absolutely.
So bottom line, do you think that we should be emulating Brian Johnson or not?
Yeah, well, I think if you want to emulate Brian Johnson, emulate what he's talking about the things that are really big hammers for your health. Sleep matters. Movement matters. And food that is enriched, especially whole foods with fiber and polyphenols, really matter. You do those three things, and you're going to add so much value to your life, you may not even need to talk about Young Plasma.
Well, that would be great. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Jamie. Really appreciate it.
That was David Nelson. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss post-surgery, post-trauma diets on The Tonic.
For over 40 years, the Big Carrot has been the community's go-to for fresh, local, and organic goodness. As a worker-owned natural food market, the Big Carrot is all about healthy living, sustainability, and bringing people together. They've got everything you need, from vibrant produce and bulk goodies to natural body care and wellness advice to keep you feeling amazing. And their kitchen and juice bars, serving up deliciousness every single day. Now, as they celebrate 41 incredible years, they're inviting everyone to join the fun. Head to thebigcarrot.ca to discover more, and follow them on Instagram at The Big Carrot for a chance to win big in their anniversary giveaways.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Shauna Lindzen is a dietitian and nutritionist. She is a program developer and nutrition leader at Wellspring Cancer Support Network and enjoys seeing clients virtually and doing corporate wellness lectures. She runs practical cooking demonstrations that combine scientific knowledge with culinary education. Her demonstrations are unique, informative, delicious, and a lot of fun. And you can find a list of her nutrition classes and recipes at shaunalindzen.com. Welcome back to the show, my friend. How are you?
I'm great, Jamie. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, a little while ago, I had, some serious health issues, extended hospital stay, lost a ton of weight. It kind of changed my essence and being while I was going through all that. And, you know, it was obviously great to get out of the hospital and recover at home. Part of that recovery was sort of, because my issues were gastric, was, you know, putting weight back on, ironically, but also like learning what to eat and what not to eat. And I was wondering whether there are other people out there too, and whether there are special, you know, dietary needs that happen when we've been through like a trauma, like a surgery or something like that. So can we explore that today?
Absolutely. And to be honest, I feel that it's one of the most important things in terms of recovery is focusing on nutrition.
Well, great. We're on the same page then. So do post-op diets actually differ depending on the type of surgery somebody has had? Or are there sort of universal guidelines when you're consulting with somebody who's just come off of surgery?
I would say both in that regard. So let's say someone has dental surgery and they can't swallow or their dentition has changed. Most definitely, they're going to have more nutritional problems and needs right from the beginning. Whereas if you compare that to foot surgery, someone who has foot surgery isn't going to be mobile, but their nutrition won't be as important per se.
Okay.
So yeah, I do feel that it really does depend on the surgery. And you're actually, we're in my wheelhouse here, because I don't know if you know, years ago, I worked in neurosurgery at Sunnybrook. So I actually have a lot of experience in this area.
So when somebody comes out of trauma, what do they need? What kind of nutrition are they lacking? And what would you recommend?
So it's not only protein that we have to worry about. We also have to worry about hydration. We have to worry about getting your bowels to move again. Because after surgery, when you're under a general anesthetic, everything stops. So nutritionally, we have to figure out how to get your bowels to move. We want to do it, obviously, in the next few hours, but we also have to worry about when you're discharged from the hospital, how you're going to have a normal bowel movement. And I know it sounds, you know, we have to talk about bowels, obviously, when
Right.
we're talking about surgery. But to me, that's the most important thing that's going to keep you comfortable.
Well, I mean, it was a real issue for me. My bowels were disconnected as I was healing. And I had to actually, in a strange way, my body had to learn how to poop again. And so I found myself in situations, and this was never the case, where I was struggling to eat because I was anxious about, you know, the system working properly. And nothing is linear, right? Like, you know, something works and then something doesn't work. And then something, you know, like food you used to be able to digest. Well, if you haven't eaten that food in a while, or if your system isn't used to processing that food, well, it becomes a strain. And so I, you know, obviously not everybody goes through that, but to me, it was really stressful.
And if you do go through that, I never say rely on medication before diet, but in the regard where you haven't eaten, let's say for a few days, anything, because you're, let's say you're not eating prior to surgery and then you have the surgery, I typically say take those stool softeners. That's extremely important because once you do start eating again, food's entering into your system, but it's not moving down as quickly. So you should listen to the healthcare professionals if they discharge you on the stool softeners. And once you get home, that's when we can move forward into talking about protein, fiber, fluid, all of those essential nutrients.
Yeah. I mean, also, like, you know me, I exercise a lot. And so I need a certain amount of energy through my food intake. And, you know, I'll process water, I'll sweat more if I'm working out. Well, all of a sudden I wasn't, right? So I wasn't moving as much because I was bedridden. And my muscles had atrophied because I was bedridden. And all those things were impacting how my body was processing fluids and solids. And I would imagine it's the same for everybody. Is that true?
It is, but it isn't. Like, let's say you do have a brain surgery versus gastrointestinal surgery. It depends on your mobility. So that's a very important point that you just mentioned, is how mobile are you going to be able to be? So I'm going to bring back to, let's say you had foot surgery. So your mobility is going to be less. Your calorie requirements won't be as high as if you were walking and moving and potentially exercising. So calorie requirements will change in the short term. And when we say you have to have so much more protein, your protein requirements do change. So for the mathematicians out there, we typically say that you'd need 1 to 2 grams of protein per kilogram of body mass, depending on the surgery, right? Mm-hmm. So let's say you have a surgery where they've cut you wide open and your tissues have to repair, and you should have more protein if, you know, for tissue healing, in other words. But you're not going to need super high protein, just high enough that you're getting enough protein for tissue repair.
What about other minerals or vitamins? Is there anything that is typically depleted post-surgery that we should be mindful of perhaps boosting?
Yeah, so I wouldn't use the word depleted, but I would use the word, are there any extra nutrients that we can provide for wound healing?
Sure.
And the two that we used to provide post-surgery are vitamin C and zinc. And these two together promote good immune function as well as wound healing. So they act in synergy together to help promote the wound healing. So and this is only briefly post-op. Like, you don't want to continue to take the vitamin C and zinc, just because once you start eating again, you will be able to get those nutrients through food.
You mentioned hydration a few moments ago. So should we be drinking more water, or are there other fluids that might be better?
Yes, excellent question. So in terms of fluids, water is always first and foremost. When we talk about adding things in like Gatorade, that type of thing. So any nutritional supplements, you have to be careful because in terms of, let's say you're still in the hospital and you're getting an IV, you have to, you know, discuss with the medical team which nutrients they are giving you so you don't overload on different nutrients. For instance, you have to make sure your potassium's okay. Right. So you have to be a little careful when you're having different, I'm going to call them electrolyte supplements. You do have to talk to the healthcare team to make sure you're not overdosing on them, especially if the surgery affected your kidney, because you definitely don't want to overdose on different minerals.
What's your experience with hospital protocol? Because I can tell you, I mean, I lived most of my adult life never having surgery. And then within the span of 2 years, I had three major surgeries, which required hospital stays. And nobody, not one person, talked to me about diet or nutrition upon leaving the hospital. Never happened.
Which probably is because you started off healthy.
Okay.
So let's say you had some your immune system was compromised, or you started off having a comorbidity mm-hmm. that's going to increase your risk when you leave the hospital, you would have most likely had a dietitian come talk to you. Like, I'm going to give you the example of heart surgery. Typically, it's protocol for a dietitian to come and talk to you in regards to post-op diet. So that would be, you know, or if you needed weight loss, that type of thing, to discuss diet in general. So it's kind of a twofold answer. It's immediately post-surgery, what are your nutritional needs versus do you need a nutrition specialist, a dietitian, to discuss, you know, the your future diet. So it's a bit twofold there. But as I said, I really think it's important to follow protocols in terms of your bowel regime. And you could get very dehydrated if you're not eating enough, because don't forget that foods have fluid, right? So mm-hmm. if you're only eating a little bit when you leave, you may be lacking in fluid in general through food and through drinking it.
One thing I experienced after my first major surgery, because it entailed my guts and, you know, all sorts of bugs inside me and everything, was sort of a lack of appetite and nausea, which I had never experienced before in my entire life. Lack of appetite has never been an issue.
Yeah.
So what do you recommend for people who are suffering that?
So I typically recommend, like, when you leave, you can start off with clear fluids, which just means things, you know, like drink, like you could even start with like juices and bone broths that have collagen in them, and green tea and ginger tea that settles your stomach. Once you move on to the softer foods and your appetite, let's say, is still not great, I normally say focus on nutrients. So for instance, oats would be a great food mixed with maybe some applesauce in there. So you're getting a little sweet. You don't want to, if you have a lack of appetite, you don't want to go towards foods that have strong smells or are very hot or cold. You want to go more towards the room temperature neutral foods. And that, again, would be things like oatmeal cooled off. That could be scrambled eggs because you're getting the protein. So typically when you're not feeling great, the blander, higher protein foods are good. So maybe if you can tolerate some mashed up beans, like a chili that doesn't have a lot of spices, like maybe some ground meat that's been sauteed. So you do want to be cognizant of still getting nutrients when you're not feeling well, which is hard.
It is.
Another one, actually, now that I'm thinking about really good ones, Greek yogurt that's lactose free. So that's one thing that's really important. You don't want to have something that our lactase enzyme typically goes down when we have surgery or when we're not eating. So you want to choose a lactose-free food. So lactose-free Greek yogurt or a soy beverage that has protein in it. So those are some really good ideas and examples to have.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Jamie.
That was Shauna Lindzen. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss triggering and discourse on The Tonic. Cataracts are the leading cause of vision loss in adults over 50. But the good news is they're highly treatable. At Oakville Laser Eye Center, patients receive advanced laser cataract surgery with personalized surgeon-led care. Using cutting-edge technology and customized treatment plans, their expert team helps patients see clearly again to help them rediscover life's details. Book your consultation today at www.oakvillelaser.ca or call 905-337-3736.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Aaron McGann earned his MA in education and PhD in psychology from Stanford University, completed postdoctoral training in child psychology and population health, and currently serves as an assistant clinical professor at the Yale School of Medicine Department of Psychiatry. He's the founder of parentingforhumans.com and divorcingdads.org, which support parents in creating strong, collaborative, and joyful relationships with their children. He's also the founder of Early Alert, which prevents suicide among students and veterans. Welcome back to the show, Aaron. How are you?
Thank you very much. It's great to come back. I'm very well. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. So the last time you were on, which wasn't too long ago, I think perhaps last month, maybe the month before, we were talking about triggering and, you know, what we can do in our personal lives if we're having conversations with people, or if we ourselves feel triggered, or if we see somebody who's triggered, how we can help them. And then we got off on a tangent, which we sometimes do here, and we started talking about triggering in a more public setting, i.e. In media, or in your expertise, in an education setting, and or in public. And I thought it would be interesting to bring you back to discuss how we can approach that best. So to start off, for those who didn't hear that interview, what do we mean when we say being triggered? What does that mean?
It can mean a little bit something different to different people, but I would say in general, when somebody says that they're being triggered, they mean that they're having a powerful, uncontrollable, really fast reaction to something that they're exposed to, usually negative, something that makes them feel either disconnected from what's going on or out of control in some way with their own experience.
When we think about public spaces like schools, media, government, who do you think holds the most responsibility in shaping conversations so that we can either avoid or perhaps minimize harm?
Yeah, it's a huge question. I think school is a different setting from almost any other setting because you're dealing with kids who we generally all agree aren't as aware and can't self-navigate as well. There are other settings like that, right? People who are not well,
right,
and are recognized to not be well, or places where there's a huge power differential that makes it impossible for the person on the bottom to navigate the situation. They always have to say yes, essentially. Right. And this can vary all the way from inmates in a prison to soldiers in an interaction with superior commanders, superior officers, and even big power differentials within a family or at a workplace, all of these things. So I think responsibility increases with power, right? We all know this. We all saw Spider-Man.
Exactly. So, yes. Yeah.
Right. So in places, as the power differential grows, so does the responsibility to be careful in terms of the things that we do that might hurt people beneath us, because we can't just expect them to say no when they're uncomfortable. It's not easy for them to do it. So the different contexts that you listed, you know, schools, government, public media, town square, they're really different. I would sort of assign a number maybe to the power differential there. Mm-hmm. Right. And then as that number grows, the responsibility grows for the people at the top to be careful with the people who have less power.
Do we really want to create sort of trigger-free areas or zones? Like, is that really relevant? Do we need to do that, do you think?
Well, and is that even possible?
Yeah.
I think about triggers a lot like allergies, right? Mm-hmm. And there are allergies that everybody would agree are real and unavoidable and not under the control of the person who has the allergy. And then there are other allergies that are sort of made up, you know, because I can't really think of a nicer word to say that. maybe I'll give a specific example. I have a very hard time with cigarette smoke around me.
Right.
Very hard time. Ever since I was really little.
Yep.
It never occurred to me growing up to say that I'm allergic to it.
Right.
Right. Because to me, to say that I'm allergic to something carries some kind of a medical connotation and like immediate harm. And again, total uncontrollability. Now, it's true. It's mostly uncontrollable. I can't, you know, just decide to be okay with it. But it's also not instantly killing me. And the first time that I heard somebody say that they're allergic to cigarette smoke, it really gave me pause. Like, how do I feel? Do I want to start using this term? Because this gives more power to me when I say, oh, please don't smoke around me. I'm allergic to cigarette smoke, right? And the use of the word trigger or allergy, one of the things that it does is it gives some power to the person who's claiming to have that experience of having an allergic reaction or being triggered. There's a risk there, of course, of people abusing that power that we as a society give everybody because we're trying to keep people comfortable and safe, right? So people might abuse it. But also as a society, of course, we want to give people the opportunity to say that they're triggered or allergic to something because we actually don't want to hurt people. And it's that's the heart of the conundrum. That's the very thin line that we need to somehow discern for ourselves. If the person in front of us is expressing something that we consider to be legitimate and worthy of protection, or if they're abusing the power that we give them to claim harm from something because there's something that's uncomfortable for them, but not exactly rising to the level of an allergy or an uncontrollable, powerful internal reaction.
I look at everything on a spectrum, right? I don't see things as black and white. I'm trained as a lawyer, so everything's a shade of gray. And I will add another piece. When we're talking about a power dynamic, we're talking about it's never an individual. It's either one-on-one or one versus many or however which number there are, but there's at least two sides to the story. And I wonder whether or not there's such a thing as a hypersensitivity and whether we really need to concern ourselves with the hypersensitive. People who are easily triggered would be like sort of the vernacular if you're going to put it plainly. But like, what's our responsibility to somebody who's very fragile or not very resilient?
Yeah, great question. And I'll go back to this analogy of an allergy, right? So peanut allergies,
yep.
Huge deal.
Yep.
People can die quickly.
Yep.
And should an entire school and all of the parents associated with that school change how they make, think, prepare meals and snacks for their kids in case there's somebody at the school that has a peanut allergy? I think it's a good question. I don't know what the obvious answer is. The country as a general lands on the side of yes. Right, we will avoid peanuts and most common allergens as much as we can. But even in the U.S., which is so cautious about these things, some allergens are not included in the list of things that you cannot ever bring to school because people say, well, that's rare enough. And at some point when it's so rare, it makes sense for people to be expected to speak up for themselves rather than for us to think about everything in advance and avoid every possible offending substance or idea in advance.
Okay. Here's where I'm kind of struggling with your analogy with allergies. Because if you are anaphylactic, and in fact, my son is anaphylactic, that's not going to change. Whereas when you're talking about somebody's resilience, I think you'll agree we can help people become more resilient, can't we? I'm not talking about extreme people who've been through extreme trauma. That's something else. There's a whole other layer of help that they need. But somebody who's just emotionally fragile, we can teach skills to prevent them from being reactive to the things that set them off, can't we?
In general, yes. In real time, usually not, right? Most people have the impulse to do this in real time. They say something, somebody else gets upset, and they immediately say, get over it right now. That's not usually a good time for people to get over it. But as people are outside of the situation, definitely when they're growing up, we can essentially inoculate them
right.
to this kind of discomfort or teach them that it's okay to experience a discomfort, which I'm guessing is what you mean by.
Sometimes ideas or expression of ideas are triggering, right? We see this in the school setting. Somebody raises a point, whether it's political, whether it's sociological, whatever, and it sets people off.
Yeah.
And, you know, without making it a free speech issue, I should be able to hear somebody's point of view all the way up until hate speech, right? Like hate speech, there's no space for that. But anything short of that, I think I should be able to listen to what somebody else has to say or their opinion without it setting me off emotionally. I may not like it. I may not agree with it. I may be offended by it, but I should be able to hear it without having a visceral response. Do you think I'm right or do you think I'm wrong about that?
I think you're 90% right. Okay. The only two tweaks I would make here, really one tweak, is it's a good idea for us to listen to other people, even if they say things that are upsetting for us, and to be able to tolerate that discomfort. I don't think we need to be able to hear it and not get upset and not have an unpleasant reaction. Like that's a very high standard. And I think that's a level of self-mastery that is very hard to achieve, to just not have emotional reactions to things that are uncomfortable for us. But I think it's important for us to learn to hear viewpoints and descriptions, maybe even of events that are uncomfortable for us, and be uncomfortable and be okay being uncomfortable.
Yeah, no, I'm not suggesting that you can't have an emotional response. What I'm suggesting is the emotional response that you might have hearing something that you don't agree with isn't enough for me to protect you. In other words, there's personal responsibility. And I think through hearing things that you don't like or experiencing that discomfort, it actually becomes inoculating, if we're gonna make an analogy. Like yeah. The more you're able to cope with it, like you have to have experience in order to cope. And I'm wondering if we're actually doing ourselves a disservice by hiving off having these discussions. And
bubbles that people live in, right? Conceptual bubbles. And correct. So they're never exposed to irritants and never develop the psychic immune system.
Correct. I mean, I know adults. I know fully fledged adults. I'm not even talking about kids. I'm talking about a time in society right now where people are gravitating towards their feelings and extremism because they can't seem to cope with opposing point of views. And they can't seem to understand what underlies it. Now, lots of people are being provocative, and there's lots of people who are being paid to be provocative and leaning into that provocation, which I don't agree with. But so I question whether those views are actually genuinely held or whether there's another agenda there. But leaving that aside for a moment, I wonder whether in addition to making safe spaces for people, we should also be helping them learn how to cope and be safe within themselves, a little bit of reliance and resiliency.
You and I talked last time a little bit, and I think this is what prompted this conversation, about how, at least in my opinion, that the biggest risk to society over the past decade maybe is people's inability to dialogue across differences, right? People cannot tolerate viewpoints that are different from their own. And this question of triggering or harm is so tricky because it's so subjective. You know, somebody who's been through some horrible event, right, was sexually assaulted, experienced some kind of like extreme other kind of violence or witnessed kind of violence, and when they hear about it, it's just super upsetting for them. Then, of course, this person deserves consideration, and I would hope that person wants to get stronger themselves and get better. But of course, we want to be considerate of people in that situation. But people who feel strongly about, you know, Democrats versus Republicans and just cannot tolerate hearing about or cannot tolerate a discussion that says, okay, they did this 100 things. Is any of them positive? And just completely unwilling to engage. I think that's detrimental to them, but also to society, because like we were saying, it sort of builds these conceptual silos, echo chambers, and people only are comfortable hearing what they're only comfortable hearing already. So to your point about building resilience, I do agree. I think that there are some things that we know in advance can be upsetting to people, and we consider legitimate subjectively, right? So we might say, look, in this conversation, I'm going to talk about a suicide attempt that I've witnessed, right? If this is hard for you, then, you know, I'll tell you before I do it and you can leave or do what you need, but it's important to talk about. And that's another benefit of this kind of a trigger warning, right? Trigger warning is not just so that people can leave. It's also so they can just fortify themselves in preparation. It's like an advance notice. Anyhow, I think there are some topics and some areas where it makes a lot of sense. I do think that if we feel like a conversation is going to be a little bit divisive or a lot divisive or potentially triggering for people, it's okay to say in advance, I want to talk about things that can be hard to talk about, but I think it's very important for us to be able to discuss them. I welcome different viewpoints. I just want to make sure that we're not attacking each other personally, but discussing the opinions. I'm not kind of shifting into thinking about how this could be done at a school or at a high power differential environment. I think it's okay to set this up. I think it's important. I don't believe in walking on eggshells all the time, lest we offend anyone about anything.
Agreed. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Dashiell Hneva, David Nelson, Shauna Linzen, and Dr. Aran McGann. Thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.